DW Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum. I'm Gabriel Borud in Bonn, Germany. On this week's show,
NTDs. One in seven humans on the planet suffers from one or more NTDs, more than the entire population of Europe.
So what are neglected tropical diseases, or NTDs? We'll have somebody who's been working for decades to wipe them off the earth guide us through some of the most vicious ones. These are diseases that science can cure and eliminate, and an international summit is taking place this week in Geneva to help make that happen. The task is truly gargantuan, and we're not there yet, but it's already been one of the most successful and impressive fights staged by the international community. So to get to the bottom of these killer NTDs and what's being done to kill them, please stay with me this week on Spectrum.
We are at the Institute for Medical Microbiology, Immunology, and Parasitology right around the corner from DW Studios here at Bonn's University Hospital. I've got my white doctor jacket on, not playing dress up. I'm here with Professor Achim Hirauf, who has dedicated 20 years of his life, more than 20 years of his life, to helping the fight against what's known as a neglected tropical disease. Which particular disease is your specialty or your focus?
My focus is the filarial diseases, and in particular lymphatic filariasis and onchocerciasis, also called river blindness, because it leads to blindness and it is transmitted alongside rivers due to vectors living there.
Where are these diseases found?
Well, lymphatic filariasis is found in the tropical areas of almost all continents except Australia, where it was actually prevalent long ago. Now we have our foci in South and Southeast Asia, India, Indonesia, and of course in tropical Africa. Onchocerciasis is mainly found in tropical Africa. There are small foci in Latin America that have been transferred due to slave trade from Africa into Latin America, but this is now almost controlled. But the difficulties to control Africa, of course, much higher.
But the people who live there locally, yeah, they're at great risk of acquiring these diseases.
Yeah, they are at great risk of acquiring. We have so-called hyper-endemic areas where 90% and above of people are actually infected and have to suffer from these diseases.
We're going to go to one of those hyper-endemic areas right now in Western Kenya. On Lake Victoria, we're going to look at a disease called schistosomiasis. I realize that it's not your area of specialty, but could you just give us a brief introduction into this disease?
Different from filariasis, it's not transmitted by an insect vector, but by contact with fresh water. And of course, one of the main areas is Lake Victoria. People were infected that would drive their cattle herds into the water to drink. Now you can also get the disease, for example, if you wash your car at the shores of the lake. And what happens is that if your skin is in contact of water, the schistosome larvae, they drill themselves into the skin, so to say, and then adult worms develop. They sit in the internal organs, and depending on whether it's urogenital schistosomiasis or intestinal schistosomiasis, eggs will be released either into the bladder and excreted by urine or excreted by feces in the gut.
We're going to go to Lake Victoria right now and hear a report by Linda Staude, presented by Neil King.
The waves of Lake Victoria slosh around the tires of a small white truck. The man, washing the vehicle, lathers up the windshield. His colleague fills a bucket from the shallows at the water's edge and carries it to the filthy loading zone. Right next to them, other people are standing knee-deep in the dirty brown tide and polish limousines, sport utility vehicles, and a light blue motorbike. Washing the vehicles in the lake isn't exactly environmentally friendly, but it's good business, says Simon Ogala.
Maybe a good day you can wash maybe over 15 vehicles. Sometimes you can even get only two or three.
He can make up to 3,000 shillings a day, about 30 euros worth. That's a lot of money for an unskilled worker in Kisumu, Western Kenya. But working in the lake water is also highly dangerous.
You cannot take more than 3 months before you'll start feeling that you are weak. Something like you are always dizzy or you feel like you want to sleep all the time.
Lurking in the water is a tiny parasite, a parasitic blood fluke or flatworm of the genus Schistosoma.
The cicada will now penetrate their skin and then transform into another stage, and then that now undergoes several migratory phases into the bodies and finally into their specific parts of the body niches where they prefer to reside.
That could be the bladder, the gut, but also the lung, liver or brain, explains Maurice Audier from the Kenyan Medical Research Institute, KEMRI. The consequence is an illness which is little known outside the tropical and subtropical regions it most affects. The disease is schistosomiasis, also called bilharzias and snail fever.
Unlike the big three, malaria, TB, HIV, individuals will harbor these infections. They are chronic infections. So you can actually carry these infections for a very long time before you feel really, really sick. But even when people feel sick, it's not like malaria that really puts you down. So people will feel lethargy, they'll feel some abdominal pain,
The at first harmless early symptoms can become life-threatening if left untreated. The long-term dangers include kidney failure, liver fibrosis, pulmonary edema or fluid on the lungs, intestinal inflammations or bladder cancer. William Otieno, who's been earning his living washing cars with water from the lake for some 40 years, says that many of his colleagues have contracted schistosomiasis over the years.
Most of them have passed away. I think I'm the only surviving old man here.
Schistosomiasis claims up to 200,000 lives each year, the World Health Organization estimates. That's also because the parasitic worm infestation is often not diagnosed. But if people get treatment in time, there's hope.
The beauty with these infections is that there is actually a very safe and efficacious treatment. So the treatment is praziquantel. It is a very safe drug. And so that treatment is actually available. We don't have a vaccine for schistosomiasis yet.
Until such a vaccine is developed in the future, Maurice Audier and his fellow researchers at KEMRI are trying to stop the disease in other ways by preventing new infections. It's lunch break time at the local primary school. The children play and horse around across the hot, dusty schoolyard. Before KEMRI started its education and research project in this school, more than 40% of the children here were infected with schistosomiasis. 13-year-old Esther was one of them.
I usually use it when washing our clothes, bathing, when going to fetch it for our animals. Nowadays, I have changed. Nowadays, I can buy water from Kiwasco and give to our animals.
Since the children began regularly taking tablets against schistosomiasis, the number of those infected has halved. The tablets are given in regular intervals, KEMRI researcher Kennedy Agengo explains.
We thought it could go more down, but it was research. So the design was after every 2 years we do it. We believe with every year intervention it can go lower than that.
But medicines alone will not solve the problem. For one, there is not yet a remedy suitable for children under six. Plus, even if the treatment has worked and someone is free of schistosomiasis, if they come into contact with parasite-infested water, they can get infected again.
If you treat fishermen or car washers or sand harvesters, you're not giving them an alternative job to do. That's their occupation. That's where they earn their living. They'll still go back to the waters tomorrow. So you might think like you're not doing anything because you're treating them. They're going to be exposed again. They'll be infected.
But the medicines do help, explains Maurice Audier. That's because the parasitic schistosoma doesn't just need a human host. It also depends on humans for its complicated reproductive process. Its eggs are released in people's feces and urine and must end up again in the lake, where they can find freshwater snails to serve as temporary hosts.
We normally advise people to use toilets, but not everybody will do that. Toilet is a good idea, yes, but it can be only good if maybe people are avoiding the lake and use toilet in order to break the life cycle of the parasite.
Says John Oguso Kuche, a KEMRI researcher who works with the car washers on Lake Victoria. But not everyone has access to a toilet, Simon Ogala says. So improving access to sanitation is an important part of fighting the disease.
Before, we did not have toilets.
But as for now, we have one of our toilets there and the second one is being built. So the behavior has changed.
But only to a certain extent. Only a few steps away from the car washers, a group of young men lather themselves up with soap and rinse off with lake water. A little farther out, a couple of swimmers splash around. This young man offers an explanation as to why so many seem unaware of the risk. The parasites are very small, so many are still unaware of how dangerous contact to infected water can be.
It is not something physical. So let's say something physical, like you are told that there is a crocodile inside, that one I think you'll fear.
Besides, building toilets, sewage systems and pipes for drinking water is drawn out and expensive. For Maurice Audier, regular free treatment for infected people with the drug Parsequantel is at the moment still the best strategy.
It doesn't prevent them from acquiring new infections, but it actually helps in morbidity control. And then over time, when you bring down the prevalence to such a very low level, there will be very few individuals in the environment who will be passing out or who will be sick. And so eventually you can actually ultimately, you know, be able to eliminate or even eradicate the disease.
It will take a combination of getting the drugs to all those infected, providing health education and improving hygiene and sanitation across the region to reach the goal of eradicating schistosomiasis in all of Africa by the year 2030.
Okay, we're back in the lab here in Bonn. As we just heard there from Neil King, It's about getting drugs to people. Your work, you've pioneered drugs for combating filariasis right here in these labs. How hard is it to get these drugs to these people?
It is, of course, a matter of public health education, which is now facilitated by TV, by internet, because you can much better educate people what the advantages of taking the drug is. It's not always only that they help you, they help your community, maybe not even helping you in the priority, but they prevent that your kids acquire the disease. So it's a bit of an altruism, which has to be educated into the population.
We also heard from Neil that it's about hygiene. It's not just the drugs, it's also about, you know, proper hygiene. Can you give us a sense of how important it is for people to practice proper hygiene in combating these diseases?
It's very important. It all although differs between the neglected tropical diseases. Take the example of schistosomiasis. Here, for example, it's very important to avoid contact with contaminated fresh water. Of course, it's difficult to clear Lake Victoria of all the snails that actually transmit the worms, but smaller lakes can actually be cleared if you collect the snails and make sure that they don't come back.
And then there are yet other NTDs, like the disease that we're going to hear about in this next report, cysticercosis, which comes from pork tapeworm. Can you tell us just a bit about this disease before we hear about it from my colleague Fabian Schmidt?
Yes, of course. Here you have to avoid to eat raw contaminated meat. In order to do that, of course, one way is to use thoroughly cooked meat, then the cysts will also be dead. But this will still expose the people who prepare the meat, probably to get the infection. Therefore, it's very important to inspect the meat because the cysts can be seen by naked eye, and this is what is being done in developed country by veterinary inspections. So if you, in principle, had veterinary inspections everywhere in these endemic areas, it could go down dramatically.
Okay, we're going to hear all about these diseases right now from Nick Martin, who's voicing a report by Fabian Schmidt, my colleague. Here it is.
Pork tapeworm is a parasite that technically should no longer exist, even in developing countries. If there were systematic hygienic policies in place, pork tapeworm would be eliminated. In the countries and areas where it is found, there is often a vicious circle of poverty, unclean water, inadequate understanding of health and hygiene, and pigs that roam free. To combat the neglected disease, cysticercosis, that arises from pig tapeworm, a comprehensive strategy is required, and education is the top priority. Everyone must be involved, says neurologist Andrea Winkler, who coordinates Cysternet Africa, a network of sub-Saharan countries combating diseases derived from pork tapeworm.
Schweinebandwurm ist eigentlich nicht ganz richtig, weil der Bandwurm
Pork tapeworm is misleading. The worm doesn't come from pigs. It's formed in the human intestine. It's meters long and the eggs from the worm exit the body in the feces. And this is where the poverty aspect comes into play. The tapeworm's eggs are eaten by pigs who are roaming about because they like the taste of human feces.
Menschlichen Stuhl vertilgen. Den schmeckt es wohl recht gut.
There are no latrines here, or they're not used, and that's how these pigs get to the feces. And when they consume the tapeworm eggs, larvae make their way through the stomach lining to the blood, organs, muscles, and brain of the pig. And if humans happen to eat this pork meat, the whole story starts anew.
Das Schweinefleisch wird nicht.
The pork isn't sufficiently cooked, and humans consume these cysts, and again, the tapeworm forms in the human intestine. Unfortunately, this is the typical cycle.
The tapeworm can grow to a length of 7 meters, about as tall as a giraffe, but it alone isn't able to kill an otherwise healthy human being. Much more dangerous are the pork tapeworm eggs.
If humans infected with the tapeworm don't wash their hands after bowel movement, then they can consume the eggs just by touching their mouth. If the larvae makes its way into the body, it can attack the organs, most of all the brain.
The cysts can live in the human brain for years without the patient noticing. Scientists say between 50 and 80% don't show any symptoms at all. But when they do appear, they can be fatal.
There are some people living with hundreds of cysts. Their brain essentially looks like a chunk of Swiss cheese. Then all of a sudden, and we don't know why this happens, the digestion of the cyst begins. The larvae don't appreciate that, and then an infection happens.
The patient's immune system attacks the remains of the tapeworm larva, and water buildup ensues in the brain, an edema. This can happen right away, or it can take years. This process can also be initiated if medication is taken by the patient to fight tapeworm in the intestines. And this can be deadly.
There can be epileptic seizures, also headaches due to increased pressure within the brain, and a number of other neurological symptoms. The pressure can ultimately increase so much that the patient dies.
Aber der Gehirndruck kann so bedrohlich steigen, dass der Mensch stirbt.
Though suffering from cysticercosis in Tanzania, Mozambique and Gambia, the countries in the Cysternet Africa network often have to travel hundreds of kilometres for treatment, for instance, brain scans. Andrea Winkler says it's crucial to get more experts from different disciplines involved in Cysternet. For instance, immunologists who study the way the body reacts to different agents, IT experts who can build up secure databases for patient data, ethnologists who understand local customs and rituals, and last but not least, teachers. And this, says Winkler, is the highest priority of all, that everyone understands a few basic principles.
Also das Wichtigste ist die Hygiene.
The most important thing is hygiene. Everyone must learn to wash their hands after going to the toilet and before eating. Food must be cleaned before it's prepared, and pork must be fully and carefully cooked. Pigs must be kept in their stalls and not allowed to roam free. And perhaps most important of all, public latrines must be built and maintained so that people use them and don't do their business in the bushes.
So that was Munich-based neurologist Andrea Winkler ending that report by my colleague Fabian Schmidt on pork tapeworm. We're going to take a short music break now. When we return, I'm here with Professor Achim Hörauf in his lab here in Bonn, and we're going to talk a little bit more in depth about what constitutes a neglected disease. So stick with us.
Yeah, absolutely, looking forward to that.
Babylon system is the vampire.
Professor Hiraf, what is a neglected disease?
Well, a neglected disease is, I would say, a disease that has not been on the radar of the health systems in Europe or Northern America, because when we travel to tropical countries, we have a rather low chance of acquiring those diseases.
So compared to malaria or tuberculosis or AIDS, these neglected tropical diseases, they're not known elsewhere in the world. But what about diseases like Ebola, for instance, which wasn't as well known until 2014, and then all of a sudden the whole world was talking about it. Where's the threshold?
I think it has a lot to do with the possibilities of really threatening us here in Europe or Northern America, where the money sits and measures can be taken against that. And we all of a sudden realized with the first patients that arrived in Europe or in Northern America undetected and became sick and then had to be isolated and measures had to be taken against spread of the disease, how vulnerable we are in new times where you can fly within a few hours from those endemic areas, more or less, to the to America and to Europe.
There were many more people with the disease than they initially thought. My colleague Connor Dillon tracked down a study that kind of went, certainly we missed, that went under the radar by two Stanford researchers who noticed that many more people had Ebola than was originally thought because they found antibodies in them.
Yeah, so just kind of a quick refresher on the Ebola outbreak, or at least the most recent one in West Africa. 28,000 cases, 11,000 deaths. This occurred mainly in Sierra Leone, Guinea, and Liberia. But what kind of some new research, some, in my view, underreported research on Ebola has shown is that the outbreak was actually bigger than that.
So what do you mean?
A couple of Stanford researchers, they were in Sierra Leone anyway, treating patients who had contracted the Ebola virus, and they went to a small town and they took a look at some of the people in this small town and realized that there were people who had contracted Ebola but who had shown no outward symptoms of the virus.
So how did they find out that they had Ebola?
So what they did, they took a total of 187 men, women, children. The village was called Sukudu. They brought them in and they looked for specifically for antibodies in their bodies, and Ebola antibodies is what they were searching for to figure out if they had contracted the virus. Now, these were people who, when they came in to the lab for this test, said, listen, I've never had Ebola. And they chose them, though, based on the fact that they were in very close contact with people who had contracted Ebola. So brothers, sisters, husbands, wives.
Okay, so essentially the researchers were looking for antibodies in their bodies.
Yeah.
Can you just do a quick test for that, or how do you?
I kind of envision it. It's a little bit like a.
They're looking for a byproduct, then.
Correct. I mean, of course, our bodies are going to be full of antibodies. It's a result of our immune system successfully fighting off various viruses, right? So when you get the flu, an antibody is produced. When you get a cold virus, an antibody is produced. So we have these in our bodies. So their task was to kind of figure out how do we find the Ebola antibody. And what they did is they did some cross comparisons. They took people who had contracted the Ebola virus, that much they knew. They'd shown all the symptoms and survived. And then they cross compared them against people in nearby villages where there were no instances of Ebola. To show that, okay, if this antibody is present in the body, it means that this person has, in fact, contracted Ebola. So that much they were certain of.
And these are cases then where it wasn't deadly.
Correct. So
if you have this antibody, can the symptoms reappear? Can it become deadly at some point? Because that's what we've been hearing about with these NTDs. They hang around in your brains, in your mm-hmm, body, in mm-hmm, the lining mm-hmm. of your stomach. And then down, like you've had it for years, and then all of a sudden it just pops up and rears its ugly face. Is that the same thing with Ebola?
That's the big question. That's kind of the scary question. What's happening here? What does it mean if you have contracted Ebola and then you have an antibody, so you've beaten it? Where is it? Is it gone? Is it out of your body? Are there people out there who've contracted it and are carrying it?
And when that outbreak happened in 2014, like these entire places were quarantined, they couldn't travel anywhere, but now people with Ebola could essentially or theoretically be traveling around the world
as sleepers, basically. Yeah, with this virus inside their body. Yeah, so that's the scary thing. Typically, headaches, rashes, bleeding, the symptoms are very clear with Ebola. These people are walking around walking, talking, they are absolutely fine. And beyond just the idea of, I mean, it changes how you quarantine, it changes how you enact security measures in these countries, how people, what you're looking for when people are boarding flights. In addition to that, it's just a larger number. So if you have, rather than 28,000 individuals affected, you might have 35,000 individuals affected. That might not sound like much, but there are equations. You've seen them in some popular films on viruses as well, that allow health organizations, world bodies, to try to figure out how they're going to tackle a virus. And those equations change if you have a much larger number of people.
The network, the spread, essentially. So what's the conclusion from this study then? What are these researchers saying?
I think, like all good researchers, they're kind of saying, let's do more research. one thing they're not sure of. For example, Ebola is...
So what do they have to find out? I mean,
Can it be transmitted sexually? If you have the if you've had it and have the antibody, can it still somehow be transmitted? Now, because of the symptoms, it transfers, right? If you have diarrhea and someone is in contact with the diarrhea, they unfortunately may contract the disease, or with bleeding, or with mucus. How does it work if it's just silently there in your body? Can you sexually transmit it? What happens? That's the big if. It's a really big, scary question, and that's the open question that these Stanford researchers have kind of left for the scientific community. And they and people like me are waiting for answers.
Connor Dillon, thank you very much for the insights on this study done, by the way, in November, right?
Yeah. November of last year.
DW, Deutsche Welle.
Professor Herauf, before we go this week, there's one question that I definitely do want to ask you. When the people in Geneva meet this Wednesday, they're talking about eliminating these diseases within the next 3 years by 2020. How do you respond to such ambitious claims?
We are talking about some 20 neglected tropical diseases, and obviously not all are on the same pace to elimination. There are some diseases where regional elimination, like from an island or from a country, can be reached within a few years to come. Others will need a few decades even in order to really have a strong impact on the prevalence of disease. For that, the WHO has adopted what they call scoreguards, so tables that they update which disease is where with regards to the planning. And I think that's in itself a major milestone, to acknowledge that not all diseases can be eradicated and eliminated at the same pace, but we need to be a bit more specific, and then we have a much higher chance of success.
Many thanks to Professor Achim Herauf, the head of Bonn's Institute for Microbiology, Immunology, and Parasitology, for his insights into NTDs and for allowing me into his lab this week. And also thanks to Connor Dillon for his help with putting together this show. I sincerely hope it increased either your knowledge or interest with regards to neglected tropical diseases. You can download the program at dw.com/spectrum. And as always, if you've got a comment or a story idea you want us to hear about, please tweet us or get in touch on Facebook or send us an email at spectrum@dw.com. I'm Gabriel Bord from all of us here at DW Science Desk. Have a wonderful week ahead. Why is monkey my set? Is monkey my set? Why is my go? Why is monkey my set? Is monkey my set? Why is my go? Is monkey my set? Is monkey my set? Why is my go? Why is monkey my set? When is monkey my set? Why is my go? Why is my go? Why is my mistake? Why is my mistake? Why is my go? Yeah, why is my mistake?